If you were in the state of Mississippi 50 years ago this summer, it would not be unusual for you to hear people talking about the racial differences in that state in terms like this.
I don't want the nigger as I have known him and contacted him during my lifetime to control the making of the law that controls me. To control the government under which I live.
That was your average racist Mississippian 50 summers ago. What he was talking about was something called Freedom Summer, a project put together by the people at the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, a.k.a. SNCC, and a bunch of college students from around the country. Here's the guy who organized that whole thing. His name is Bob Moses.
We hope to send into Mississippi this summer upwards of 1,000 students from all around the country who will engage in Freedom School, voter registration activity, and open up Mississippi to the country.
All of this is featured in a terrific documentary that will air on PBS Channel 9 tomorrow night called Freedom Summer, and it features many of the people who participated in that effort to register African Americans in Mississippi, thus empowering them in a state that was half black, but only 7 or 8% of them were registered to vote, because it was literally risking their lives to try to get that constitutional right. One of the people who participated in that is one of the college students who went to Mississippi that summer, is from right here in St. Louis. His name is Chris Hexter. Today, he's an attorney with the firm of Schuchat, Cook, and Werner, and he joins me now here on the Big 550 KTRS. Hi, Chris. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Thank you for joining me. How did you get recruited?
Well, it's an interesting story. I was a freshman at the University of Wisconsin. The university at that time held a series of programs in which the university brought in speakers from around the country, including that summer, that fall and winter, George Wallace, James Reston, and a professor who had escaped from Mississippi, literally from the University of Mississippi, named James Silver, who had taught at Ole Miss for 27 years, at the point at which James Meredith was the first black student to attend Ole Miss. And James Silver was the only professor who reached out to Mr. Meredith, and for that he was literally hounded out of the state, ended up as a visiting professor at Notre Dame. He came and spoke, and students could apply to be in a small colloquium with the speakers. I applied because I had read James Silver's book called Mississippi, the Closed Society. Literally, during the colloquium, I pulled out a napkin, and I wrote on the napkin to Professor Silver. I said, I'm fascinated by Mississippi. I've read your book. I'd love to go there and work in any capacity and whatever, just to be there. And I went up to him after the meeting, and I just handed him my paper napkin. And unbelievably enough, usually you do that and it's pitched, but he didn't. He handed it to two white students, passed it on to two white students who worked in the civil rights movement, but underground, while they were attending Ole Miss. And they knew about the summer project coming up, and they wrote me, and the rest is history. I applied to the project, which, as you just indicated, was the brainchild of Robert Moses, and I applied, was interviewed, was sent to a psychologist because they wanted to exclude people who had sort of messianic complexes or just wouldn't work well. And I was admitted.
So
that's the story.
Because you had heard these people speak and because you had read that book, you knew about the violence, the white supremacist stuff that was going on in Mississippi. And when you were recruited to be a part of this trip with hundreds of other college students from around the country, did somebody explain to you what the real risk was, and did you understand that you were really walking into something that was unlike anything else in the country?
Well, I certainly knew one was at risk for being arrested. One was at risk for potential violence. I don't think that's the number one thought that one would have going into something like that. I guess you sort of set it aside somewhat for why you're going. But I knew it, and had to justify doing this to my parents, so I had to go through their questions, and they were many from them, and obviously issues about violence and risk. And so, yes, I knew it because the summer before that, a man who was admired by many in Mississippi was brutally murdered at the front door of his house, Medgar Evers. And the person who murdered him was acquitted in a trial that year in Mississippi. So it was not something I was unaware of.
It was several years later that Byron Della Beckwith, the guy who had committed that crime or organized that crime, was finally convicted and committed to prison. But originally that all-white jury had let him go because that was the environment there. And I talked about the risk. If you can you describe what the risk was for the African-Americans who simply wanted to register to vote?
Yes. I worked, when I went to Mississippi, the college students who went down there were assigned to several different, many different areas in the state. And I, personally, I had the good fortune to be assigned to Sunflower County. And at that point, the project was headquartered in the small town of Ruleville, Mississippi. One of the more famous people to come out of the civil rights movement in Mississippi and then the rest of the country was a woman of very humble means named Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer. And she lived in Ruleville. And Mrs. Hamer was, like many African Americans, she worked as a sharecropper, which meant she was given a small plot of land, she and her husband, and in return for that owed services to a plantation owner and picked cotton. Although she was a little higher up, she registered the cotton that was picked by many other people working in the fields. And Mrs. Hamer was approached by my project director, but before I came down to Mississippi, a man named Charles McLaurin. And who knows what fear she overcame, but she decided to go down and register to vote at the county seat, Indianola, Mississippi. And she registered. By that afternoon, her name was given to the owner, the plantation owner on whose land she had a small area to grow her own vegetables and also lived. And the plantation owner came up to her that afternoon and said, Fannie Lou, unless you go back down and pull your name off that list, you're going to be thrown off the plantation. And Mrs. Hamer responded, I didn't register for you. I registered for my own interest. It has nothing to do with you. He said, I don't care. If you don't get your name off, you're out of here. And so Mrs. Hamer was forced off that plantation and moved into a very modest shack in Ruleville. 1 year later, she was involved in the movement and was traveling, and she became a field secretary organizing for SNCC. And she was on her way back to Mississippi from Atlanta and was stopped in a small town on a bus in a small town named Winona, Mississippi, where she was taken off the bus, arrested, put in jail, and beaten so badly by trustees in that jail at the orders of the sheriff there that she could never walk properly again for the rest of her life. She always had a limp. So she was a prime example of somebody who's registering to vote caused her to lose her job and caused her to be physically brutalized to the point she could barely walk again.
The newspapers in Mississippi, when they would find out the names of the African Americans who had tried to register to vote, even if they hadn't been successful because of the way the registrars ran things in those offices, the newspapers would print those names and people would lose their property, lose their jobs, have the banks call their loans for their small businesses or whatever it was. I'm glad you mentioned Fannie Lou Hamer, because she's an extraordinary part of the civil rights story that really hasn't been told very much. And it really extends from there to her becoming one of the great spokespeople of the Freedom Summer movement and the civil rights movement in general, which actually took her all the way to Atlantic City, where some Mississippians were trying to change the way the Democratic Party did things. And it ended up, this is a remarkable part of the story, it was Fannie Lou Hamer versus President Lyndon Johnson, right?
Oh, yeah, it was a remark, and it's picked up very well in the movie that people can see at 9 o'clock tomorrow on Channel 9. But, yeah, Mrs. Hamer, essentially one role, part of the summer project was to create a counterpart to the then all-white Mississippi Democratic Party, which was really the only serious political party in Mississippi, as much of the South then, as much the Democratic Party being an all-one party now to the South being an all-Republican party. But part of the summer project was to create a counterpart to the all-white delegation, and the counterpart was to, in effect, have a convention, elect delegates from all over the state in an open way, encouraging anybody to run as a delegate, so that the delegation sent by the challengers was an integrated delegation, unlike the all-white Mississippi Party delegation. And in order to do that, you had to then go to what was called the Credentials Committee. Now, the major speaker, there were a number of speakers from all over the country on behalf of that delegation, but the speaker who captured the moment was Mrs. Hamer, again, a person of very modest means economically, a very modest education. I'd probably only gone through school through the fourth grade, but a person who was intelligent way beyond her objective academic background. Well, Lyndon Johnson was so paralyzed, freaked out by this challenge, one, because he feared losing the South, and he feared if he lost the South, he would lose the election to Barry Goldwater. And so when Mrs. Hamer was speaking to the Credentials Committee, her speech was very early on pretty powerful. And so Lyndon Johnson, seeing that, literally called a press conference to announce virtually nothing, no new event. He simply came on, but this press conference was announced, and he simply made a statement that the date in which he was speaking was 9 months after President Kennedy's assassination. There was no new project, no new proposal. It was purely with the intention of getting Mrs. Hamer off the air, but he didn't succeed because all the stations recorded what she said, and it then went on that night at prime time. And anybody who watches the movie, the documentary tomorrow, will just see the power of this very just impressive woman, who in part of her impressiveness was the degree to which, under very tense moments, Mrs. Hamer, like many in the South and many in the communities in which we work, a fundamentalist Baptist, just could belt out in beautiful ways the songs of the civil rights movement, and did that, in fact, on the bus back to her hometown in Ruleville right after she had tried to register to vote when the bus was stopped by the sheriff. So this is a woman whose stature was just well-respected all over the South and all over the movement.
Yep. You use the word impressive, and it certainly applies to her. I'm Paul Harris, talking with Chris Hoekstra, who was a participant in Freedom Summer in Mississippi 50 years ago, an attempt to get African Americans registered to vote. Even in counties where it was majority black, less than 10% of the blacks there were registered to vote because of the white supremacist attitudes of the people who ran those things, from the registrars to the sheriffs to the police departments, etc. This is all told in a terrific documentary by Stanley Nelson that will air tomorrow night on Channel 9 and the PBS network across the country as part of the American Experience Project. So when you went to Mississippi, were you part of the voter registration part of this or some other aspect of Freedom Summer?
I was a Freedom School teacher. If you heard the again in the intro to this segment, you heard Bob Moses speak about the project, and the project had a number of focuses, one of which was to try and register to vote, people to vote, which was, in terms of numbers that summer, pretty negligible. First of all, people were terrified to go vote for the reasons that you very well stated. And so what one other aspect of that, as an aside, was to make a record of how difficult it was for people to vote so that that could go to Congress to be the trigger for what eventually became the Voting Rights Act, which was passed later in 1965. The other aspect of the other prong of the project, in addition to registering people to vote in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, was to set up throughout the state a series of what they called Freedom Schools, which were to provide for both students and adults a counterpoint to the education that adults had had when they were younger, and for elementary through high school students a counterpart to the education that was imposed on them. Amazingly enough, from anybody who knows how hot it is in St. Louis in the summers, it was hotter in Mississippi, and yet African-American students were forced to go to school in the hottest time of the year because schools were run around the cotton cycle. So we set up these schools. We had books that came in from all over the country to different towns in Mississippi, and there were schools in many of the towns. And we had professional teachers and people like myself who were college students who taught a whole range of courses from nutrition to English reading courses to writing courses to courses on African-American history to courses on the history of African-Americans in Mississippi to courses on civil liberties, just the full panoply of what could be provided under, again, in very modest surroundings, oftentimes outdoors, in fact. My first class was taught to a series of adults outdoors sitting on benches in Ruleville. And then later that summer, we were lucky enough in Sunflower County to get a foothold in Indianola, the county seat. By the way, the place where the White Citizens Council, which we call the Klan in Suits, was founded the day after Brown versus Board of Education came down, 10 years before the project. And we, in Indianola, set up a school. And to give you some sort of sense of it, students in my class wrote plays. They acted out in the plays. They acted out the roles in the plays. We set up a student counterpart to the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, where students in each of the schools elected their own delegates to what was called the Mississippi Student Freedom Democratic Party. And they wrote out their own vision of what their town should be and their own vision of what a Mississippi Constitution would be like. So it was an incredibly exciting ferment, and interestingly enough, a ferment that has had an impact way beyond what we could have ever imagined. So the model of Freedom Schools was taken up by many educators. Much of that experience has been written about and used in schools around the country in terms of its sort of free, allowing students a sort of free expression, which they had just not had for years. I mean, everything in Mississippi was a flip side. I mean, if you were black, how do you explain to a black kid in a public school, you know, whites can vote, you can't? Why is that? You know, and so those questions couldn't even be asked in public schools because the teachers couldn't answer them, because if they answered them, they'd be fired. So the Freedom Schools were a counterpoint to virtually everything that existed in the public schools in the state.
There's one aspect of this story that we haven't touched on, which people may know if they don't know the rest of what we've talked about Freedom Summer. They may know because there was a movie made in 1988 called Mississippi Burning with Gene Hackman and Willem Dafoe and Francis McDormand and Brad Dourif, which was about three of the volunteers or three guys who were part of Freedom Summer who disappeared and were then found to be killed and buried in Mississippi. That was Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner. That happened relatively early on in Freedom Summer. Did you know about that where you were in Mississippi?
I did know about it. As we talked about, there were a number of prongs to the project, the first prong being voter registration, really to show what Mississippi was all about in terms of that area of the law. And then the second prong we talked about is the freedom schools. Well, the volunteers went down in two waves. The first wave were the people going down to register voters. The second wave were the people going down to work in the freedom schools. And by the way, the movie really does capture the impact of the freedom schools on Mississippians. There's a student from Hattiesburg, Mississippi, who's now a PhD, who said that was the schools were the trigger point for him rethinking his life and realizing there were opportunities out there that he just simply never had. But going back to the story about Mickey Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andrew Goodman, part of the project was to show America what Mississippi was all about. And you know, the thinking was, by Bob Moses and others, is that they were having such a miserably hard time dealing with voter registration as black civil rights workers, very much alone in that state, that they felt they had to get the eyes of America and really the eyes of the federal government onto Mississippi. And they couldn't have anticipated how horrible it would be, but literally I arrived in Ohio 50 years ago this past weekend, because this weekend is the 50th anniversary of what turned out to be murders. And I arrived on a Sunday. And I think if you chart back, it probably was June 21st, but it's very close to then. And we had a meeting in Oxford, Ohio, which was the training center, a small Catholic college. So we met with people who were the regular, who'd come up from SNCC to help train us to go down, to give us a sense of what Mississippi was all about. Part of that was to let us know how serious and how careful we had to be down there. We had that meeting, we go to dinner, we're all sort of sitting around talking, and then we were all called back to this auditorium. And in front of the room was Bob Moses and this young woman. And Bob Moses said to a hushed auditorium, "We've just learned that three workers, one a new volunteer, two then a high school student from Meridian, Mississippi, and Mickey Schwerner, who ran the program in Meridian, have been murdered, or have disappeared." They had done this, they had gone up to Philadelphia, we were told this, because of a church that had been burned. And then we don't know what's happened, but we have to assume the worst. And then a woman got up and spoke, and her name happened to be Rita Schwerner, and she had announced that, you know, her husband had disappeared, Mickey Schwerner, and she was incredibly, stoic. And she was stoic the whole summer. And she said, basically, and we all felt, that it was likely that these three men had been murdered. But we didn't know it, but we felt it. It turned out our suspicions were correct. We could not, you know, what I think was surprising is Mississippi lived up to its reputation so quickly. I mean, they just arrived and they were dead within hours of their getting Mickey Schwerner back to Mississippi, James Cheney back to Mississippi, and Andrew Goodman had literally been in Mississippi for hours before he was dead. It took about 5 to 6 weeks before their bodies were found in an earthen dam. And it took, in part, the U.S. Navy, the FBI, all of which Lyndon Johnson was being pressured to do by a whole series of forces. And that was depicted, as you said, in the movie is Mississippi Burning. And I'll just leave an aside about that movie. That movie portrays a bunch of black folk who were living in total abject terror. And I can tell you that that was not the summer. My own experience was the summer was the flip side of that. Although there was violence, I was arrested 3 times. I spent some time in jail. And so there, we can't deny that there was these brutal murders. And there were arrests. And there were some beatings. The people who I thought were afraid were the white community. Mm. Their world was being changed, and they were freaked out about it. And some of the times they struck out in violence. Other times they were just, you know, I think just freaked out. Their world was being changed. I think some knew that their world as they had it was wrong. I can give you a story in both Ruleville and Indianola. That summer, folk singers came down from all over the country, including Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, Peter, Paul, and Mary, a Broadway cast of a play called In White America came off Broadway, came down and did the play in Mississippi. Well, whites would be terrified to get near or enjoy that, but these were small towns. It wasn't like there was a lot of great stuff going on in the white community in the way of high-end theater. And here are these musicians playing in the outdoors in the black side of town. And so you'd see these white folk coming by in their cars with the air conditioning on, with their noses smushed against the window of their cars, trying to get a glimpse of what was going on, too afraid to get out of their cars for fear that something awful would happen to them. But fascinated by this world in which the exciting stuff going on in town was not in their side of town. It was in the, you know, African-American side of town. I mean, it really was. I mean, you know, where the excitement was not in if you want to call downtown Indianola downtown, it was not there. It was over in the very modest sort of quarters in the black community.
Yep. It's ironic, Chris, that fear is still what drives so many policies in this country from people who are having their worlds changed in so many ways. I want to finish just by saying that this Freedom Summer documentary that Stanley Nelson did, which will air tomorrow night on Channel 9 and which you are a part of, is really a remarkable document of American history that I hope people don't forget, because it's so easy to have things like this repeated, both for good and for bad. And I hope that it doesn't just air one time and then go away. I would love to find out that schools across the country are showing this to their modern day students, because it's an important part of history for us all to remember.
Well, thank you. I agree. I mean, I am forever indebted for the months I spent down there. And I'm going down right tomorrow morning. I leave from Mississippi.
Wow.
For a reunion of us old codgers. So.
Well, I hope you enjoy that, and I'm sure Mississippi is different than it was 50 years ago, and I appreciate you sharing some of your stories with us here today.
Thank you.
That's Chris Hexter, who's an attorney here in St. Louis at Schuchat, Cook, and Werner, who focuses on labor and education and employment discrimination law, so he's still pretty much in that same field. 50 years ago, he was part of Freedom Summer in Mississippi. You don't want to miss that documentary tomorrow night on Channel 9. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.